Hey, thanks so much for listening to this message. My name is Jason, and I'm one of the ministers here at the Madison Church of Christ. It's our hope and prayer that the teaching you hear today will bless your life and draw you closer to God. If you're ever in the Madison area, we'd love for you to stop by and study the Bible with us on Sundays at 5 p.m. or Wednesdays at 7 p.m. If you have questions about the Bible or want to know more about the Madison Church, you can find us online at madisonchurch.org. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast, as well as our sermons podcast, Madison Church of Christ Sermons. Thanks again for stopping by. I hope this study is a blessing to you.
So yeah, tonight we're going to pick up a week 7. My goal is to finish chapter 3 tonight. It's kind of where we're at. I'm going to jump ahead a little here, kind of our goals. We're on track. We've got about, counting tonight, 7 more classes, and that's going to get us where we need to be. As each week's going to, after this week, we're going to pick up the pace with the chapters, one per week for sure, with chapter 9 and 10 being the closer. I wanted to hesitate and dwell on chapter 3 for 2 weeks, last week and this one, because of so much context. So I wanted us to spend time, and I know I kind of went off book a little bit to talk about the Magi and the culture. We're going to do a little more of that, but it's important because I've hoped to challenge us all to think about the book a little differently, hopefully, in ways, not trying to do what, not un-Bible, not, you know, trying to, you know, we're just preaching and teaching Bible when we're in class, but to really think about the context and everything we see in chapter 3. There are just so many details about the behaviors of these people that are so important to understanding what's about to happen once the ball, we're at the top of the hill now, and after tonight, that ball's fixing to start rolling. 4, 5, 6, 7, it's about to go. And tonight we go from Esther. It's kind of odd because she has been kind of a pawn. I talk about a queen. To this point, she's kind of just being moved in position, you know? We talked about Esther in chapter 2, and then she kind of goes away. She's just kind of getting pretty and being the king's wife. But after tonight, it's Esther or bust, right? So we're going to talk about that. Before we do, I want us to, again, kind of wrap up with Haman tonight. Talk a little more about some of the things I said about the Magi, the wise men, and the traditions of the poor, the lots, which will kind of get us to where we need to be, and get to where, hopefully, if we have time, we might start chapter 4, but I think we're just going to do finish 3, where we get up to Esther taking the reins. But I want to start by reading something, and if you want to turn with me, we're going to be between Esther, Proverbs 16. I'm going to start there tonight, if you want to follow along. But I want to do something a little different, because I want us to think about what Mordecai and Esther would have had access to, you know, as Jews in exile. This certainly is the wisdom literature. They would have been familiar. And I want to start and think about, as I'm going to read this, if you'll, what I want you to do, either follow along, or I want you to sit and critically read this and listen to it. And I want you to think about it as an overlay to the story of Esther. Okay? Everything I read, I want you to think for a minute as I read. How many of the characters and actions do you see happening in Esther? Okay? Because we've seen the evil acts of Xerxes and Haman. But, you know, what does Esther and Mordecai have to base on? What's their foundation aside from blind hope? Well, I think Proverbs 16, many commentaries say, this is one that we can clearly see the characters. And I want you to think, I put some images up here as I do every week. At the top, it's the Persian lion and griffin, the very mythical creatures as well as the very real that symbolize power and paganism. But for Esther and all these things that Haman cast lots, the Magi, all these artifacts that I never try to pull from fringe sites. These are all things from verifiable museums. The astragali, I mentioned that last week. The astragali are those little knuckle bones in the bottom left. That's probably what Haman threw or was thrown. But I want to start with Proverbs 16. I'm just going to read through this, and then we're going to jump in. And I want you to think about the characters of Esther. The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. All the ways of a man are pure in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the spirit. Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established. The Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of trouble. Everyone who is arrogant in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Be assured, he will not go unpunished. By steadfast love and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for, and by the fear of the Lord, one turns away from evil. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. An oracle is on the lips of a king. His mouth does not sin in judgment. A just balance and scales are the Lord's. All the weights in the bag are his work. It is an abomination to kings to do evil, for the throne is established by righteousness. Righteous lips are the delight of a king, and he loves him who speaks what is right. A king's wrath is a messenger of death, and a wise man will appease it. In the light of a king's face there is life, and his favor is like clouds that bring the spring rain. How much better to get wisdom than gold? To get understanding is to be chosen rather than silver. The highway of the upright turns aside from evil. Whoever guards his way preserves his life. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. It is better to be of a lowly spirit with the poor than to divide the spoil with the proud. Whoever gives thought to the word will discover good, and blessed is he who trusts in the Lord. The wise of heart is called discerning, and sweetness of speech increases persuasiveness. Good sense is a fountain of life to him who has it, but the instruction of fools is folly. The heart of the wise makes his speech judicious and adds persuasiveness to his lips. Gracious words are like a honeycomb, sweetness to the soul and health to the body. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is death. A worker's appetite works for him. His mouth urges him on. A worthless man plots evil, and his speech like a scorching fire. A dishonest man spreads strife, and a whisperer separates close friends. A man of violence entices his neighbor and leads him in a way that is not good. Whoever winks his eyes plans dishonest things. He who purses his lips brings evil to pass. Gray hair is a crown of glory. It is gained in a righteous life. Whoever is slow to anger is better than the mighty, and he who rules his spirit than he who takes the city. The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord. Any of those verses, and maybe you come back to it later and think about it as we read, but any of those jump out to you that maybe describe characters from Esther? Any of those particularly resonate with you? What do you think? Any of those kind of sound like, that sounds like Haman or Esther? What do you think? Anything jump out? The light of the king, light of the king's face. So the king, you know, getting the king's favor, and right? Okay, Ben mentioned about the light of the king, king's favor is like a spring rain, the face of the king. Now that has multiple meanings, and actually, we're going to see that tonight with the spring. I'm not saying this was written for Esther, but Xerxes and the kings of Persia had an obsession with spring, an eternal spring. It has a lot to do with why Mordecai is unable to get to Esther after he goes into mourning. So I'm going to take us back, and I want you to think about some of these verses as we go, as we kind of wrap up chapter 3. So a summary of where we got so far, just the first 11 verses, just to summarize. You know, we talked about Mordecai in the courtyard every day from Esther 2. We learned that Mordecai was a gatehouse administrator according to Bible and secular records. We know he refused to bow to Haman, so that's where we're at in the plot. We know that Haman, it said he was uplifted to second, essentially a vizier status. That's the term we would use in some translations. There's some other terms I'm going to show you. We don't know why. Now, I'll say this is speculation. It could be, I didn't mention last week, it could be unrelated. Haman has recently been promoted, probably due to being an unscrupulous advisor, telling him what he wanted to hear. It could be because of Mordecai, what Mordecai did, right? Remember, Haman was sort of above the officials, and he was elevated above all. If Mordecai saved the king, Haman got the credit, right? That could have happened. It could be, we don't know, that Mordecai does that. It gets reported. Haman goes, he gets the credit, because everybody's probably been in a job where that happens. Middle management gets the credit, right? Not to knock any middle managers, but it's that kind of thing, right? It could be. Mordecai, happy to save the king. Mordecai gets uplifted. We don't know. But we do know Haman was over all officials, and that phrase means something in Persian. We'll get to. Neither bowed nor paid homage. We talked about how it was important that Mordecai didn't bow entirely, and a few reasons why. Let's remember that there was an issue because of Mordecai's Jewishness. He says, because I am a Jew. Or rather, if you read the text and look at your translation, it's not even clear if Mordecai says, I am a Jew. Some of the translations say that, but some of the translations imply after his friends interrogate him, they figure out he's a Jew, right? Either way, it's not something Mordecai was trying to just gloat about, because we don't really maybe have time to go into this, but he's been telling Esther not to tell the king she's a Jew, right, this whole time. Now the cat's out of the bag, and it's unfortunately caused some problems. I mentioned some things we need to remember about Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar. Just a generation or two before, we have evidence of Jewish people, much like Christians today, commanded to obey the law and authority, right? Pay your taxes, obey authority, don't revolt. However, there's a line to cross, right? We will not disobey our God. We see that Mordecai has drawn a line because of the Agagite, Amalekite ancestry, for one. Haman is enraged, right? We've already established that he hates Mordecai because he finds out, not only did he insult me, but he's a Jew. Oh, he's a Benjamite. Oh, I hate those guys, right? We know he had something against them. There's a parallel chiastic structure here. I mentioned chiastic structure in week one, the parallel of the story. Every action has an equal action, right? There's sort of a, you see this happen. There's a parallel storyline here going where we have a chance in one way for Mordecai and Esther to do what their ancestor Saul did not, right? This is not about that, but it's part of it, right? Mordecai and Esther are courageous because they get a chance to play a part in God's story and to come through for once, right? That's part of this. We have Mordecai and Haman. Now, one thing I'll mention this week, I've shown several of these artifacts over the weeks, and I wanted to show a different side of one. There's so much story here in these artifacts. Now, when it comes to the court and bowing before the king, we often think of these sort of courtly bows or getting down on your knee, but often it's more, and Islamic traditions pick this up, but you'd often see this, sort of a kiss or sort of a get down on a mouth sort of bow, or depending, sort of do this and get down. So this is an example of, this is Darius in front, actually, and supposed to be Xerxes behind him. They didn't look exactly like that. Most of them drew them looking exactly the same, so it had that every king, this is the divine, right? They had the massive beard. Xerxes was not that tall, but they drew themselves taller. But this is an example of probably what Haman looked like, I'll tell you, because we can tell this is like a vizier coming forward because the little funny hat. And I mention that because the bowing's a big deal. And so there's a Herodotus, one of our historians I've mentioned, wrote about this when he observed them. He says, when Persians greet each other in the street, you know whether or not they have got the same social status. Because if they have, they don't greet each other with words, but by kissing each other in the mouth or hand. If one of them has a little bit lower status, they kiss each other on the cheek. But if your status is much less noble and much lower, he offers reverence by bending down and prostrating in front of him. So here we see, if you're before the king, and we see a picture of this, where it's just this, and they did it for two reasons. It wasn't just a kiss. They would do this, but it was also, this is why I explained Zoroastrianism last week. They had a big thing about cleanness, and their priests, they always did this, the idea before the king, that if they covered their mouth, it's preventing, they were very germ, not germ theory yet, but they were very much like, I don't even want to breathe on the king, I am unclean before you. So they would do that, and it was a sign of reverence. And this guy is barely leaning, so that tells us before Xerxes, he's probably second in command. Mordecai would have been a little under this by now, so when Haman says Mordecai doesn't bow, really wasn't that Mordecai was supposed to get down and do that, right? But Haman wanted more. We know from Haman's character, that's what he wanted. He wanted everyone to bow down. I'm important. The king says to bow. Okay, here you go. Get down on your knees. You know, he was very much like that. But we see this in their architecture where you can see behind that other guys. Now, we also see examples. This goes back beyond, and I want to say the Persians, Babylonians, and Assyrians had a lot in common, okay? They're not the same people, but the Persians essentially took on the Assyrians and Babylonian traditions, okay? So the bowing started in Assyria. This is an example of one of the ones I showed you, I think, from the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser. This is when King Jehu of the Israelites was subject to the king. See how low he is? And they would do that. So if you were a king they conquered, it didn't matter. That was on purpose. When you came before Xerxes, down. That's your submission. So the Persians would do that. So that's what Haman wanted Mordecai to do. And this is how Persians would treat the conquered, right? So that's important to remember in our story. A couple things about the protocol of the court. Once more, as we get into up to chapter 4, this is important. Once we get to 4, because I feel like we often rush over, well, you know, I'm not supposed to go before the king. There's a lot going on here, okay? They had some cool names for their court. You had the Shahanshah, which was kind of the Persian name for the king of kings. That's Xerxes. Followed by a second in command called the Hazarapatis, or the Chiliarch. Translated in English, it's called the Master of 1,000. Doesn't that sound cool? That was the Master of the Immortals. Xerxes' Immortals. They were the special Green Berets. They were also in charge of essentially the court, taking the burden off the king. Sound familiar? That's what Haman's about to do. That's why Haman has his left ear. Okay, the only person that could be in Xerxes' presence to have that conversation was the second in command. When the Bible says Haman was lifted up over all officials, he truly was. The word we use today is vizier or prime minister. Beneath the master of 1,000, you would have a variety of people, the chief officials, the stewards, the cupbearers, his son Artaxerxes and Nehemiah. We find Nehemiah is the cupbearer of Artaxerxes, okay? The bureaucrats. Then you had the eunuchs, the head of the house of the women we've talked about. So, and below that, or with that, is Mordecai now, okay? Mordecai has been lifted up, and he has a position called the king's eye. That's what we read about in Persian history. It matches what the Bible says. After he spots the assassins, he's lifted up to be sort of over that, right? So he's sort of in charge of intelligence, okay? Mordecai is now over keeping the king safe. He's not quite as high as Haman. But remember, I mentioned a few things about the Magi. Mordecai bowed, but not to another god. It's probable that Haman was dressed like this, okay? Because I want us to remember this too. I keep coming back because after tonight, the Magi weren't all bad, okay? The wise men. They were the scientists. They were the smart people. They were the ones who were mystical. But they weren't all bad. Every satrap, all 127 nations, had a core of these guys. They were the lawyers. They were the scientists. Most of them were pretty neutral. They were truth seekers. But the Persian ones, under Xerxes, I'll put it this way. If you've ever seen the cartoon version of Aladdin, Jafar, the evil vizier, that's Haman, okay? It's a little cartoony, but if you were the court vizier for Xerxes and you hadn't been killed yet, it's because, guess what? You're reading the bones, and you're telling Xerxes whatever he wants to hear to stay in power, right? That's what they did. Herodotus writes about this. The Persian magi who were left were dressed ornately. They liked the finery. They embroidered their garments. You bowed before them. They stayed just behind the hand of the throne, you know, the power behind the throne, right? So we know, I hope, after last week, we talked about Haman's connection to the magi, the wise men. In chapter 3, in chapter verse 7, he casts lots. He consults the soothsayers. He either himself was a magi or was in bed with them, essentially, right? He knew of them. He used them. I think it's kind of somewhere in between. But I want us to remember that most of these wise men were dressed very plainly and humbly. And I say that to defend them a little bit, because by the time we get to chapter 4 and 5, I hope you'll kind of see them a little differently. They themselves have a lot in common with the Jews, we're going to find out. And it's because of Esther that the traditions are preserved through the Magi up to Jesus being born. So we see about lots being cast, and here are a couple of images I put up before just to remind you. This is more like what a general Magi would look like, very pale. This is a white stone, but they wore robes. They kept their faces covered. They carried these little things that were collections of sticks. They wore these silly little hats. This is more of a gold one. This is more of the Persians. But they would cast lots, like dice or things. But that's kind of what they would do. So, because I wanted to bring forth a couple of things before we move on, and I do want you to be thinking about this. This is another stele from the back end. This is Darius and Xerxes. You see this little guy here with a little crooked hat, the robes, kind of looks like Albus Dumbledore from Harry Potter. That's what they look like. That modern tradition of fantasy and fiction gets that wizardy look from these guys. That's where it came from. And that's why people mistrusted them, even then. They were weird even for ancient religions, right? The Greeks thought they were weird. They didn't understand them. They thought they were goofy. They wore goofy hats. They wore pants, which was weird to the Greeks because real men only wore dresses. That's how the Greeks thought about it. Shows you how culture changes. But they would wear long robes, but underneath they wore those. But I want us to remember that because a couple of notes I mentioned. Generally, the Magi had this idea of good and evil, this god called Ahura Mazda versus Ahriman, the kind of a devil figure. But the Persian Magi had sort of made it a little more complicated. They worshipped a character called Mithra, which was picked up later by the Romans. It was about knowledge and things like that. This is important because I didn't show this last week. This does not go away. If you ever see statues in Rome or Greece of a little guy with a Phrygian pointy hat, he's always killing a bull or has a little sun over his head. That's not Apollo. This was a cult that started at this time called the Cult of Mithra. Okay, this was what we call those witch cults. Okay, if you're ever curious about where Wicca, witchcraft, a lot of those things, Gnosticism. They may sound familiar, getting to that, the Gnostics of the Bible, the secret knowledge, the inside club, the Masons, all that stuff, started here. And it lasts all the way through the 5th century before it's crushed. Now, this was a good thing in some ways because these knowledge seekers were preserving everybody's history for us. So God is using them. They were good librarians. But they were also bad. Because, and I encourage you all in your homework, if you want to go back and reread Colossians. Colossians, the entire Colossian heresy we read about in the New Testament, just to show why it's important for this to go away. If you reread Colossians 1 and 2, Paul is addressing an area. That's what he's talking about. That Colossians there, who were new Christians, and archaeological evidence backs this up, they were confused because they were sort of worshiping these knowledge cults, right? They didn't understand. That's how come they were worshiping angels. They got this from the Mithra priests. They were worshiping angels. They thought powers of the earth, like the Persians, fire and water. They wanted to believe in Jesus, but they thought Jesus was just another Zeus, right? So the Colossian heresy, all these Isis cults and things like that, the syncretism, where they blend folk religion with Christianity eventually, this started in Persia, okay? So I want to remember that because it's a negative, because it's a cult, but it also allowed, God used it for us to preserve in a mystical way the prophecies of Isaiah and so on. Any comments or questions so far through chapter 3 at this point? Anybody have anything curious about or have a question or comment? This is one of the examples you see in Persian architecture of the king riding on these wings. This was an example of Ahura Mazda, the god of knowledge. Every king painted their face on it because they wanted to be worshipped. Okay, so moving on into chapter, back to where we were in the middle of chapter 3. We talked about how a little bit getting into the end of chapter 3 here where the lots are cast, okay? Pur, the word for lots in Persian. Now, it's important to understand the dates, okay? Nisan, the 12th year of Xerxes. When I was a kid, I remember reading Esther. Maybe you were the same. Maybe you're better than me. You're probably all smarter than me. I know you're smarter than me. But, you know, I read the story, and it felt like it happened in a week. You know, a kid, what did a kid know about time? But, I mean, a lot of time has passed. We're in year 12. You know, how long does that mean, if you remember your math from the class? How long has Esther been queen now? Want to take a guess? 5 years. Not fair. Physicist up front got it first. All right. Esther's been queen for 5 years. Let that sink in, right? This wasn't just yesterday. She's had, now that has some effects here on the story. 5 years a queen, 5 years living and doing who knows what in the palace, but she's had time to prepare. God has had her learning how the Persian court works, right? And this, we're not going to reread it, but if we read through verse 11 where it talks about court politics, and getting to the end. So this is something I wanted us to look at, and this is important about Haman's date. Because again, after this, things move fast, and Esther has got to move fast. Okay? But because of Haman's idolatry and paganism, Esther and Mordecai have about a year to save their people. This is the lunisolar calendar of the Hebrews. They used a lunar-solar combo, which is why the dates sort of drift. So when it says in the Nisan, I believe in verse 7, in the first month, which is the month of Nisan in chapter 3, in the 12th year of King Xerxes, they cast Pur. So there was often a 12th or 13th month. You'll see 12 months here. But sometimes, depending on the dates, they were kind of fluid, which is why we're in Purim now. We're coming out of Purim. But this is when the lots are cast, right? And he does so, and this is when Passover is happening soon, right? And Purim has not been instituted yet, but it's about to, right? So Pur, based on, and Im, by the way, the word Purim comes from just the end, Im, that suffix on the end just means like plural. So when you add Im to something, that means many, okay? So basically it's talking about casting many lots, right? But this is when it happens, and Haman, if we read through down through chapter 11, or verse 7, he says, we cast it month after month till the 12th month, which is the month of Adar. So Haman, now there's different translations, and I'll let you think about this, but some translations say it like he sat down and he just kept rolling the dice until Adar came up, right? Some translations say he did it every month, he did it for a long time and just took the average, right? He kept doing it until, some translations say he cast it over and over again and Adar kept coming up. Okay? That's why I read Proverbs. Because the last verse in Proverbs 16 says what? It says the lot is cast, right? But God is the one, right? God's the one in charge of the outcome. Haman wants it to be here probably too because it's fitting, right? We're about to come into Passover when even they knew what Passover was. They were celebrating coming out of destruction. What better way to get vengeance on your hated enemy than to crush them when they're happiest, right? So the 13th was chosen as a date. If you read down through chapter verse 11, it doesn't say the lots told him the 13th. It says he picked that date, right? And that's a date that's going to go down in history because we'll find out later once Purim is established to this day. This is called Esther's fast, okay? When Esther begins to fast for 3 days, the Jews today start on the 13th. They'll fast, right? A fast for Esther and her feasts to bring us from destruction to redemption. So we have sort of when this is happening now, and we're right here. So Haman has cast lots, and he's about to give a decree, and it's going to go to all of Persia, meaning Esther and Mordecai have 11 months to prepare their people for what's coming. Okay? So back in verse 7 again, just an example again of the reading signs. They called it cleromancy. Kind of talked about this already. They cast lots to figure this out. They used these dice with names of months, kind of mentioned this, but this is how they did courtly intrigue, right? If you use that, you got the backing of the king. Now, we already know why Haman hated Mordecai. He has a vendetta, and I mentioned last week that Xerxes didn't see it that way, right? No people means no taxes. No taxes means no money. No money means no war, right? So you had to have a very good reason. They didn't tolerate rebellions because when Xerxes did act, remember, he was petty and he would absolutely genocide somebody without a second thought if he wound up thinking it was a threat. But he doesn't want to have to do that. So I want you to remember as we get to the end of chapter 3, Haman's superstition here. Haman was second in command. All he had to do, he commanded the immortals, the army. He could have gone ahead and said, let's do it. Hey, Xerxes, a certain people is giving us trouble. And you can imagine Xerxes drunk, back from war. I've described him already to you. History backs it up. This is a broken king. He's done. He's got beaten in war. His wife is mad at him, right? Vashti has not gone away. She's been put away. He's having to deal with the politics of that. He didn't know what to do. He ran from his army. He's not over in Greece. The rest of his army's still fighting, right? He's back at home getting drunk and, you know, having time with his women, his concubines. Haman says, I'll take care of this matter. Certain people's giving us problem out in the West. It's out there. Don't worry about it. I got you. And Xerxes is indifferent to it, which is a lesson here about leadership. This is another man in power who has a privilege to lead and a chance to do good. Even as a pagan man, but he's indifferent to his choices, and this is a problem. Haman now feels like he has the backing of the, this is a Xerxes coin, by the way. Xerxes on it. It's the archaeological find. Haman thinks he has divine support. He's going to have vengeance on the house of Benjamin. But notice in verse 9, where it says, if you'll kind of go there with me, he says that certain people are scattered abroad. Their laws are different from those of every other people. They do not keep the king's laws. So it's not to the king's profit to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who have charge of the king, and they might put it into the king's treasuries. Haman attempts a bribe here, okay? Xerxes, do you notice what he says next? He turns it down, right? He says, the king took a signet ring, gave it to Haman the Agagite, and he says, the money is given to you, the people also, to do with them as it seems good to you. So he's kind of saying, keep the money, go do it. Why does he do that? And I've got a hint there. I want to see what do y'all think? He doesn't take the money, which is 10,000 talents. And if you do the math for this period, the talent thing, the stone weight, at this time in history, anybody want to take a guess as to how much money in dollars today that would be? A lot? You bet it's a lot. In today's money, that would be somewhere between, this is a long range, I know, but it's somewhere between 135, 450 million, depending on the rate of exchange at the time and however the wars were going. This is how it goes. We're talking about several million dollars, 460 tons of silver. Haman might have that much money. Xerxes turns it down because of bribery. I told you on week one, Persian boys are taught three things: how to shoot a bow, ride a horse, and to tell the truth. They claim to despise bribery. However, that's only when people are looking. This was court protocol, because what they would do, Herodotus records for this again. Thank you, Herodotus. What they called tribute, they had three ways of doing it. You tax your people, you're offered tribute, i.e., hey, king, here's some gifts from us, leave us alone. And a third one, you got your tribute from the value of the people. What do you think I mean by that that's different than just getting money? Slaves? It was blood money. This happened in other precedent there. What they would do, and they had precedent for bribing the Greeks. They lied. Xerxes bribed. We have history. He bribed the Greeks to be there was a guy named Demosthenes to go Benedict Arnold on the Greeks and side with him. They bribed everybody like crazy because people are crazy. Spare me the platitudes, right, Xerxes? They would turn down bribes and they would say things like, no, keep the money. But what they expected was to see that money come in the form of a gift. And what they plan to do to the Jews, scholars think, that amount of money, that's blood money. Essentially, that means Haman is wink, wink, nudge, nudge, saying, here's that winking. We just read Proverbs. Somebody who winks, don't trust him. That amount of money is saying, I'm going to liquidate them, right? When we crush all the Jews, there are a lot of them, a lot of Jews. Their property, income, and worth will be 10,000 talents. We'll crush them, seize all their assets, put it in the treasury, right? That's what they did. That was the extreme measure. They didn't want to do that. But all Haman had to hear was, I've already been beaten. I'm a joke because my wife, I sent her away, but I'm dealing with that. I've been married to this Esther for 5 years. We're about to find out she's not in his good graces anymore, really. And now he's hearing about another revolt. Just take care of it, Haman. I don't even want to know who they are. He doesn't know who they are. It does not tell us that he knows it's the Jews, right? Because he doesn't care. He also doesn't know Esther's a Jew, right? It's going to be part of the story. Moving on to verse 10, you'll notice it says, so the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman the Agagite, son of Hammedatha, enemy of the Jews. And the king said, money is given to you, do with it as you will. This was bad. That's what Haman wanted. All he needed was the ring, right? Give me the ring, Xerxes. Xerxes gives him the ring. It's all I need. He goes and makes a decree. These are examples of clay that were stamped with various signets found under the palace of Susa. It's hard to tell. They're various signets of Xerxes. I know it's hard to tell up there, but they all involve him showing masculine displays of him ripping animals apart. He's absurd. Everything of Xerxes is him being this masculine 7-foot-tall guy. He's none of that. You know, any guy that talks like that, anyway, you've got these rulers that they're just showing off. He's not. Now, one unique thing they found in the palace is this one. It's one of the few insignias of a woman, and it's called the Ishtar signet. And a lot of scholars think this might have been something granted to Esther, We don't know. But this was one of the few women that were found. So we see the royal signet has been given. And that gets us to the last three verses, which is kind of where I wanted us to get to tonight and wrap up the chapter. So let's read verse 12 to 15. So this is where Haman makes it legal. The order is given. And Susa gets upset, the palace. So in verse 12, then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month. Okay, so they're summoned on the 13th day of Nisan. And an edict, according to all that Haman commanded, was written to the king's satraps and to the governors over all the provinces and to the officials of all the people, to every province in its own script and every people in its own language. I want to pause there. Haman makes the decree, takes time to have a scribe very clearly make sure that all 127 provinces will have it in three different languages so there's no confusion. He's going to get this done, right? It was written in the name of King Xerxes and sealed with the king's signet ring, right? It's got Xerxes' name on it. I don't know if any of you have been in a weird, awkward position at work where you had to do something and you did the paperwork and then somebody else signs it. Well, you know, that's kind of what's happening. Xerxes is to blame here too. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with instruction to destroy, kill, and annihilate the Jews, young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. You see, that verifies what I'm just saying. The point was to kill them, annihilate them, empty the treasuries. Xerxes is a complete failure. I know there's a lot of commentaries in history about what this guy did, but he is a long way from his father Cyrus. By all accounts, Cyrus the Great was a good man. He was a pagan. He did some evil things. I'm not trying to excuse it. But honestly, if you look at history, Cyrus is that patriarch who does a good job and has a bunch of sons, and every one of them fail. Cambyses fails. He has a son named Smerdis. Darius and somebody else, each one do terrible things, some of which I have a hard time reading, okay? Honestly, there's nothing the Romans did aside from crucifixion that's as bad as what the Persians did, okay? Persians were terrible, okay? They ruled, they called it the Persian Pax, the Peace of Persia, but let's remember, everybody, anytime one country has a big time of peace, it's because somebody's been oppressed, right? That's the nature of these things. Whenever there's a massive ancient world peace, somebody's been conquered, right? A lot of the world was in peace after the Jews got conquered, they would say. The Jewish people didn't see it that way. So we have a time here where Xerxes is essentially handed over his power. A copy of the document in verse 14 was to be issued as a decree in every province by proclamation to the peoples ready for that day. The couriers went out hurriedly to the king, and the decree issued in Susa, the citadel. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Susa was thrown into confusion. Does anyone have a different word in the last verse there that does not say confusion? I've seen agitation. I've seen different ones where they're confused. And there's a reason for that. Real quickly, does anybody remember, why is a royal decree in Persia a big deal? Do you remember? Why is it a big deal if you make a decree? What is it that happens? Can't be rescinded. Xerxes was subject to the law of the land, okay? He could do what he wanted. But every time he made a decree, and let's remember, let's not summarize Esther, okay? Esther's not going to win here by getting Haman, by him to just say, hey, yeah, let's break the law. He has to issue another decree to give the Jews a fighting chance. That's all Esther's asking for, right? It could not be rescinded, could not revoke it. You could only add new decrees. And at the end here, we see verification that all 127 satraps get it very quickly. A lot of scholars criticize this part because they say, this is why you know there's no way mail went that fast. Well, that was true until archaeology discovered their postal system, and they had a quick way of getting it through. Think about the beacon system. They would go between these systems and do it. So Haman distracts Xerxes with drink. Xerxes, defeated, back with his women and drink. He relents easily. And this is just a reminder. The text verifies for us once again that we're in the 12th year. Esther's been queen for 5 years. Any idea why, and we'll try to close on this, when it says Susa was agitated, the palace of Susa, why do you think that is? Why are the people upset about this? Yeah, are they going to come for us next, Ben says. That is a lot of it. And a lot of these Jews, you got to remember, they were taxpayers. It's never been God's people that are the problem, ever, right? It's not the Jews or the Christians, not in Rome. Jesus had nothing, he was blameless. The Christians were just paying their taxes and still got, you know, this has been going on back to anti-Semitism with Jews. Yeah, the people of Susa were starting to think, what happened? What happened to Cyrus? What happened to the great empire where we're all protected? Boy, does the apple fall far from the tree. Wes Canaday taught our class the other night. He's not here. We talked about phrases. We talked about fathers and sons. People are nervous. Xerxes is not his granddad. He would never do this. So the people are nervous about this. And this is where we see Xerxes' empire showing some cracks. You know, you can't rule corpses. And the people are nervous because now they're thinking the Jews they work with. Think about Nazi Germany. I mean, I hate to jump there. I'm not trying to, and I'm proving Jason Hilton right by saying a man cannot talk about anything without mentioning World War II, Rome, or cars or sports. And I've already done that. But think about it. That's what we're talking about. You know, this is a Nazi Germany level thing where we have hatred of a people. The people are nervous. Their neighbors are going to disappear in a year. Because let's be clear. The decree goes out and says, in a year, you're gone. And that leads us to Mordecai mourning. And I want you to think, I'll talk about this next time as we close. This is where the Magi come up. Because the last time this happened was in Darius's reign, his father, when Darius went on a pogrom and had almost all of the Magi killed because he was worried about them. Somebody asked week one about the Medes. The Mede country was made up of the Magi. Darius had almost all of them put down because he was afraid they would rise up. If that sounds familiar, because their numbers are many, right? Sounds like Egypt and the Jews. And what happens if they rise up and stop serving us? We better kill them or enslave them. So I want to bring that back up next week. These oppressed people like the Magi, the truth seekers, they're nervous because now the Jews are being taken. What happens to us? So next week, we're going to start chapter 4. We're finally there for such a time as this. Because after this, Esther is going to have to step up and Mordecai says, I'm out. Esther, we have one shot. And we see Esther become the queen she's supposed to be. I'll see y'all next week.